Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. We're in depth on the president's first pick for the court. President Trump had announced he'd reveal his choice for the court on Thursday. He has moved that announcement up to tonight. You can hear live coverage at 7 o'clock our time. This hour, we're going to talk about how the person the president wants to replace, the late Antonin Scalia, would influence decisions on big cases and big issues before the court. I'm also interested in whether a new justice will significantly change the chemistry of the court and really how much that matters. As our guests join us, I'd like to hear from you on this. Was the Supreme Court a key factor in your choice of a candidate for the presidential election? And if so, what were the specific issues that mattered to you most? Give me your top two issues so we can get as many people as possible in on the calls here. And I'd love to hear from some women voters on this as well. So if the Supreme Court was a key factor in your choice for a presidential candidate, what were those top couple of issues that really motivated your vote? And of course, everyone welcome on this. Love to hear from some of our women listeners as well on this. 651-227-6000. 800-242-2828. We're on live at nprnews.org/live, and I'm on Twitter at Carrie NPR, where Anna is saying the Supreme Court nomination was the number one issue that swayed my vote. Mara saying I definitely voted with Supreme Court nominees in mind. So you can reach me on Twitter on that at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I. NPR. Our guest today, Eugene Volokh, is a law professor at UCLA. We find him this morning in Tucson. And Eugene, welcome back to the show. It's good to have you here.
Always great to be on. Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah. Kimberly Atkins is with us. She covers the courts and politics as the Boston Herald's Washington correspondent. And she's with us today from Washington. And Kimberly, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Kimberly, I just wanted to ask you, because I know you're in D.C. and you're covering some of these events from overnight. I see the Senate committee looks like it's about to vote on Attorney General nominee Jeff Sessions. Are they moving more quickly because of what happened with the acting Attorney General, the fact that she was fired overnight?
Yeah, no, this was already scheduled to take place. The vote of the committee is the first step to advance Senator Sessions' nomination to the full Senate. And that's going on this hour. You are correct.
And is it your sense that there may be a different makeup of votes on the committee, given what happened with Sally Yates overnight? Or was this always just going to be a straight along the line partisan vote?
Yeah, this definitely changes the context of this nomination and this vote, but it seemed to be a pretty strong partisan split even going into this before the controversy at the Justice Department. So I'm not sure if that will have an effect on the committee vote or even ultimately on the final vote in the Senate, although I was watching on Twitter on the way over here that some folks, Angus King, announced that he was going to vote against Jeff Sessions, the independent senator from Maine, but I think overall it'll be tough to stop this nomination, considering that the Republicans do have a 52-seat majority in the Senate.
Okay, Eugene, let's talk about the court choice. And I'm interested in the way President Trump is doing this. Is one of the acts of a new president that always gets a huge amount of attention, you know, a selection for the Supreme Court. So the party base pays attention to that. The media pays a lot of attention to it. And I guess I wonder if that attention is really warranted in your view.
Well, sure, because long after our president is gone, his Supreme Court nominees, if confirmed, are on the court, affecting our nation's law. Now, each, of course, is only one vote of nine, but it could be the swing vote, and many presidents get more than one nomination. Now, to be sure, sometimes I think people exaggerate the importance of the court. There are hugely important parts of life in which the court plays very little role, like almost all foreign relation matters, matters having to do with whether to go to war, whether to stop a war, matters having to do with spending and taxation and such. By and large, the Supreme Court only deals with them at the margins. But other things that people care a great deal about, such as the right to bear arms, or such as abortion rights, or such as the freedom of speech or religious freedom, those are things where the Supreme Court plays a tremendously important role.
Now, we have a caller, I think, Eugene, here, who is thinking of precisely what you just mentioned there, to Mark in Bemidji. Hey, Mark, you say you voted for President Trump. What was on your mind when it comes to court issues?
Well, what I appreciated, or what I liked about what he was saying, was the commitment to the rule of law, and also to protect individuals' rights to liberty, including the unborn, the rights to life, but also to the Second Amendment rights to protect oneself.
Okay.
So that's what did it for me.
Yeah, thank you for the call, Mark. Eugene, back to you on this. Are there some key cases that you're aware of that would be where the court would be deciding some of those issues, as we've said, on abortion rights or on gun rights or anything like that?
Well, I don't know of any important cases that are going through the system right now. That is to say, really very major cases. But let's take gun rights as an example. The court was before Justice Scalia's death basically 5-4 in favor of the proposition that the right of the people to keep and bear arms is the right of you and me to keep and bear arms,
mm-hmm.
The right of individuals to keep and bear arms. If Hillary Clinton had been elected, it seems very likely she would have appointed a justice who would have taken the state's rights view, which is that the right is conditioned only on membership in a National Guard or some such organization, is therefore effectively not an individual right. It's not certain, but it's pretty likely that that's the kind of person she would have nominated, and then the court would have been 5-4. Probably, not certainly, but probably in favor of rejecting the right to bear arms, or even if they didn't outright overturn the D.C. v. Heller decision, they would have limited it to next to nothing. Now, on abortion rights, things are not quite the same, because right now the court, even when Justice Scalia was on the court was 5-4 in favor of protecting at least the core of Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the notion that there is a right to abortion subject to limitations. So this particular nomination doesn't implicate that. But, of course, if Justice Kennedy or, say, Justice Ginsburg or Justice Breyer retires in the coming years, then in that case that might implicate that. It is interesting, I should say, what the caller said about liberty, and I do agree that liberty is very important. It reminds me, though, of of President Abraham Lincoln's quote that we all declare for liberty, but in using the same word, we do not all mean the same thing. He was talking in the Civil War, where the South was saying we want liberty, liberty to own our property, meaning slaves. And the North was saying we want liberty, liberty for slaves not to be owned. Likewise, abortion is an excellent example. One side says we want liberty of the woman to control her body to get an abortion. And the other side says, yes, we believe in liberty, but liberty of the unborn to be free to live a life without being killed. I'm not saying who's right and who's wrong here, but it's just a reminder that people can be really committed to liberty, sincerely committed to liberty, but just have very different understandings of what liberty means.
Are you sure you're not saying who's right and who's wrong? It sounds like you do have a view on that.
You know, actually, on abortion, I'm perhaps one of the very few people who really, I'm not sure what the right answer
really?
Is. I think I appreciate the arguments on both sides. I think there's an interesting question whether the Constitution should be read as recognizing right to abortion. But I've heard great arguments on both sides of certainly the policy debate. I just want to highlight that you can't talk about these things, and the same thing is true of right to bear arms. Some people say, well, liberty to defend yourself. Actually, that is a liberty I agree with. Others say, well, we want liberty in the sense of freedom from being killed, and they think that we need to ban guns in order to prevent violent crime. Again, I happen to disagree with that position, but it's another example of why just saying, are you pro-liberty, isn't terribly helpful, because there's so many different understandings of what liberty means, all of them sincere, all of them defensible.
Okay.
And really the question is, are you for a particular understanding of liberty?
Here's Francie on Twitter. She says, woman here, I voted with LGBTQ rights in mind. Also, women's rights are my concern. And then Ivan says, LGBT rights were big for me, along with civil rights. The Supreme Court announcement feels like an attempt to distract from the immigration issue outrage. Here's a call for you, Kimberly, from Chuck in Minnetonka. Hey, Chuck, what were you thinking about when it comes to the court?
Well, what really soured me on the court this way it was is when they redefined marriage. And I did not agree with that. But beyond that, if you're going to start redefining words that traditionally for hundreds of years people have agreed on the meaning to suit your agenda, then there's no end to it.
I think, Kimberly, Chuck, thank you. He's talking about the case that in essence legalized same-sex marriage.
Yes, the Obergefell decision by the court that was issued. And that was a decision by Justice Kennedy. And most legal experts that I talk to say that that is probably not likely to be disturbed in a Trump administration, given the makeup of a court, certainly not with just this first nominee who would replace Antonin Scalia as conservative for a conservative in that case. But there are other cases on the docket, too. To speak to the Twitter comments that were made, there's a case on the docket this term that considers whether it involves a school, a transgender student, and an Obama administration era rule that denied federal funding to schools that do not allow transgender students to use the bathroom, the restroom that coincides with their current gender. That rule is being challenged. And right now we have a 4-4 split on the court. And so whether or not Donald Trump's Supreme Court nominee is installed in time for arguments in that case, which are going to be in April, could make a difference in that case. So there are things that could change. Again, I don't think the abortion issue is going to change with the installation of the first justice, but perhaps with the second, as Eugene said.
So if you've just gotten in on the conversation here, Kimberly Atkins is with us. She covers Washington and the courts for the Boston Herald. And Eugene Volokh is with us. He's a law professor at UCLA. The question I'm asking you, as you hear us kind of go through the docket and we talk about the chemistry and the makeup of the court, was the Supreme Court a factor in your choice for a candidate? That emerged in a lot of polling before and after the election. And I'd like to know about the specific issues that really matter to you. Give me two. If you have a number of them, give me your top two. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter at @KerryNPR. Kimberly, just to come back to you, you mentioned Kennedy. Kennedy occupied a unique role on the court as a very important swing vote, got a lot of attention for that. Do you think that changes given with this replacement?
Yeah, I think he returns to that role once Donald Trump makes his appointment, because then again, you will have, I mean, Donald Trump is choosing from a list of 21 potential justice candidates that was crafted with the help of the conservative group, the Heritage Foundation, and also the Federalist Society. So it will be a conservative justice. It will be someone who's replacing a conservative justice, Antonin Scalia. So in that case, you sort of have four on each side, with Anthony Kennedy in the middle. So he will return after sort of being pushed to the side for the last a year or so to that spot, at least with this appointment. Now, the next appointment, depending on who it is, could take him out of that role by giving the court five more solidly conservative justices, and he'd have a little less sway than he does currently.
Eugene, as someone who, is it fair for me to say that you're on the conservative side of the political spectrum here as a legal scholar? Yes.
You know, I'm sort of a libertarian-ish, conservative-ish, maybe moderate.
Okay,
I'm a man of the center-right, I think, on the American political spectrum.
Man of the center-right.
Which makes me extreme right by the standards of law professors who lean
I
very
gotcha.
Far left.
Especially at UCLA, probably. But, okay, here's my question for you. So what do you think of Kennedy occupying this role again, as Kimberly laid it out, with this new nomination to the court? I mean, does this give you more anxiety about the role that Kennedy's going to play?
Well, I'm not sure anxiety is called for. This is the reality of the way the Supreme Court works. We have 9 justices, and because a lot of issues split 5-4, whatever justice is kind of closer to the middle is the swing vote. It's just like in American politics more broadly. There are these swing voters who are disproportionately courted because people figure they can count on the base. At least in ordinary elections, you have to go after your base because you're afraid that maybe the base won't show up, and then you'd lose even if you win the swing voters. On the Supreme Court, you know that everybody has to show up, so the swing voter becomes very influential. And Justice Kennedy isn't the swing voter in all things, but he is on many. That's the reality of the system we have. Many people are somewhat skeptical about it. They say, you know, why do we give so much power to the court? And in particular, why do we give so much power to the justices for so long? Maybe we should have, some people say, maybe we should appoint them for 18 years.
Like term limits,
and then
right?
That's the end of their term. And in fact, then, among other things, we might be more likely to appoint people who are, let's say, 60 and have that extra experience rather than look for people in their 40s and early 50s on the theory that then they will serve for longer. So one could argue against this kind of model, but that model is the reality. It's the system that we have now where one justice on a lot of issues can have a great deal of influence. That's the way we do things, rightly or wrongly.
Michael on Twitter says, my two top issues, protecting women's rights and individual privacy in a world of emerging technology. To the phones to Amanda in St. Paul. Hey, Amanda, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Hi. How are you thinking about the court and the question that I'm asking?
Well, I'm a lawyer. I'm a female voter. Mm-hmm. I voted for Hillary Clinton. And one of the most important issues for me, well, there's two issues, really. One is that our court fairly and accurately represents the populace as a whole. And I think with Trump and the nominees that, well, the people that he's considering to nominate for the court, he will return it again to a male-dominated court. I think it's important that we have women and people of color and different experiences and different religions, because the justices naturally bring their biases, their experiences to the decisions that they make that affect our entire country for decades.
I appreciate the call. Kimberly, you've probably seen the long list and then the short list. How many women were on that short list, and how many perhaps men or women of color were on that list?
Yeah, the list is predominantly male and white of this list compiled by these conservative groups. There are some women, including Diane Sykes, who made it to the list. But in terms of the short list, the shortest list, it's either, depending on who you ask, 2 or 3 people right now, all white men. They offer some diversity in a different way, which is right now the Supreme Court is very coastal. It's people from the East Coast and the West Coast. It's people from Ivy League universities. And there are a lot of people on the list who come from different places. And also currently all of the justices are from federal appellate courts. On the list, there are people from state courts. There are people who have had political backgrounds. One of the finalists on the list, Judge Thomas Hardiman from the Third Circuit, he drove a taxi cab to put his way through college. His father owned a taxi service. So, and he is from Massachusetts, but he spent most of his time in Pittsburgh, most of his career in Pittsburgh, which is a Rust Belt type state that got so much attention during the election. So there, we may see diversity in some different ways, but not necessarily in terms of women and minorities.
Eugene, what do you think? Do you think it matters very much that a justice have the kind of experience that Kimberly just described for Hardiman, Does it matter that they come from a top academic law school? What's your take on this?
Well, I just want to return for a moment to the caller's call. And I appreciate the arguments for having a Supreme Court that looks like America, a Supreme Court that's representative of America. But let's be blunt about what that means. That means that Merrick Garland, that it was correct to reject Merrick Garland simply because he was Jewish. Because after all, he would have been the fourth Jewish Supreme Court justice. And I'm Jewish myself. I don't think that's the way a president should decide. I don't think the president should have said once, say, Justice Ginsburg was on the court, we shouldn't appoint Justice Breyer anymore. We shouldn't appoint Justice Kagan. We already have one Jew. That's 1/9 of the court. That's 11%. Jews are only 2% of the population. They're overrepresented. We should now be looking for more Protestants. Incidentally, right now, I believe there is no Protestant on the court, even though Protestants are the majority faith in America. There are before Justice Scalia died, there were 6 Catholics and 3 Jews. So if you really believe in, well, we need to have a woman because women are 50% of the population, then in that case, you have to also say, well, okay, we have too many Jews. We have not enough Protestants. Let's have religious quotas for the court.
I don't think that argument follows at all like that. Eugene, I don't think that – I do not buy your logic on that. I say, you know, appoint more women to the court because you need that perspective and you need that experience. And I don't think you can cross that out because people aren't using faith as – the lens for those choices.
No, but let's think this through. So without doubt, one's sex is an important aspect of one's identity and one's experience. One's religion is surely a very important aspect of one's identity and experience as well. In fact, my guess is religion actually predicts votes on political candidates more closely than does sex.
That's
if you look
your
at the
guess.
Gender gap, there's a bigger religious gap.
That's your guess. Do you have any evidence to support that?
Sure. The gender gap among voters as a whole this election was unusually high. I believe the swing was about 12%. Whereas, for example, for the one group I'm most familiar with, which is my own group, which is Jews, the swing was probably closer to about 50%. So the correlation between sex and vote is much, much weaker than correlation between religion and vote. So what I'm saying is once you start playing identity politics for the Supreme Court, especially when you don't just say, look, there ought to be some representation, but say it's got to be proportional to the population, then in that case, it's hard to see why it's limited to sex and doesn't extend equally
Kimberly,
to religion.
Kimberly, let's note that it has been very, very unproportional when it comes to gender on the court for a very long time.
This is true.
Eugene, hang on a second. Eugene, I'm going to let Kimberly speak on this, okay? Kimberly, go ahead.
Well, I was going to make the point on how whether or not religion is a predictor of outcomes. Just one quick point is Justice Sonia Sotomayor and Justice Antonin Scalia shared a religion, but they probably agreed at least on very controversial issues such as abortion, affirmative action, things like that. They agreed very little. So I'm not sure that is quite the predictor.
Well, this is not a perfect predictor of outcome either. The justice for whom I voted, Justice O'Connor, has a very different view, for example, on affirmative action and on various other issues than other women justices. One of the women on Trump's long list, whom I also happen to know, Allison Ide, who is a justice in the Colorado Supreme Court, probably disagrees with Justice Sotomayor, just to give the example we're talking about, on a very, very great many things. So it's true, religion is not a perfect predictor. Sex is not a perfect predictor. But again, once you go down the line to proportionality, once you go down the line to quotas for we need to have this many women on the court, we need to have this many of some other group, then it's hard to see why you wouldn't have the same thing for religion as well. And I'm suggesting that it's better to step away from that.
Sarah says on Twitter, as a Republican, I know many who didn't like Trump but voted to get a conservative judge on the court. Wonder if they're now questioning that at what cost. Amanda says, absolutely, I'm pro-choice, pro-marriage equality, and pro-strict gun laws. Will Trump's nominee be a female or person of color? Probably not. To the phones here to Matt in Decorah. Hey, Matt, thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
No, the top two reasons I voted for Trump was, one, abortion and two, gun rights. And the third, I just want to throw the third in because it's important and you're seeing it now, is the how people are acting. Like in Decorah today, for example, there's another protest, and locals and the people on the outside of it think of it as a joke. I own a business, and people come in from other towns and say, your town is full of crazies, and it's really sad.
Well, but, Matt, so I assume that you know that your town's not full of crazies because people are protesting, right?
Well, actually, you should come to Decorah and check it out. It's ridiculous. There's one today, but people from outside communities coming in think it's ridiculous. But the main reason that I was calling was for the abortion part of it. I just want to throw this at you.
Okay.
Or just let let everybody hear it and take it as they will. It's illegal to kill, let's say a woman gets in a car accident, but somebody hits her and kills the baby. That person is then charged with murder for killing that baby. But a woman can go and have an abortion and kill the baby and doesn't have nothing happen. And they say, because the society says
Matt, I'm afraid your logic just isn't holding there. Eugene, perhaps you'd want to talk about privacy and the court's decision on Roe for a second.
Look, I appreciate the caller's logic. I also appreciate the argument on the other side. The caller's position is essentially the law treats at times, and rightly treats at times, the fetus as a human being, and that you shouldn't be able to kill human beings, with maybe a few exceptions, self-defense, lawful executions, war. We know there's standard exceptions, but you can't just other than that, you can't kill them. That's what happens in an auto accident, at least under the laws of many states. The same should apply to abortion. The argument on the other side is, well, a fetus isn't really fully a human being. And while we think that the fetus deserves some degree of protection, hence the law that the caller pointed to, at the same time, the woman's right to control her body should trump, at least up until the point of viability, or about the 5-month mark, or maybe 6-month mark, depending on the state, should trump whatever interest this fetus, as not fully a human being, should have. Those are two plausible positions, and the country is very much split on them. So I think there's a logic to both positions. It's just, I think at some point people have to decide when it is that they think that life starts.
Kimberly, let me, Eugene, hold on a second. Kimberly, let me come to you on whether Roe v. Wade, there has been a sense that it is settled again for the time being, but that there are other cases coming up that will change the way clinics are permitted to offer abortions and that kind of thing. What's on the docket that may affect Roe or abortion provision services?
Well, you're exactly right. There are cases working their way through the appellate courts that deal with a number of state laws that were passed in recent years that put restrictions on abortion services, everything from physical plant restrictions requiring clinics to have facilities like a hospital, which most of them don't, or requiring doctors who perform abortions to be affiliated with a hospital within a certain mile radius, which most aren't, and it has the effect of closing down a lot of providers of abortions in these states. That's making its way up. And again, I think with this first appointment, it would be a lot harder to disturb Roe. But on the other hand, Donald Trump promised. He really gave two specific instances, sort of litmus tests, if you will, when he talked about Supreme Court justices. And it's the ones that many of your listeners have mentioned, which is abortion and gun control rights, and that those things are important to him. We also have to remember that this is Donald Trump, a man who is known to change his mind, and someone who for most of his life was not particularly pro-life. He identified as pro-choice for a long period of time before that. So who knows whether he will stick to this list that was compiled by conservatives. But that is one of the litmus tests as of now that he's stating. And again, with the second appointment to the court, that would give the court a strong conservative majority if that is replacing for example, Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Stephen Breyer, then that could make a real give the court the opportunity to revisit Roe. But you also have to remember the judicial principle of stare decisis. There are, and this is something that the Chief Justice has talked a lot about, this notion that if there is settled law, then unless there's some sort of extraordinary change from when that law was settled, that should remain in place. Roe v. Wade has been the law of the land for nearly 44 years now. So it would be difficult for the court to explain why now it is suddenly disturbing that if it decides to do so.
Kimberly Atkins with us from the Boston Herald, Eugene Volokh with us from UCLA. And I'm asking you if, as a voter, Supreme Court issues were top of mind, one of your top priorities when you chose your candidate for president. Here's something else I want to mention. The Pew Research Center, in some polling that they did around Supreme Court and issues, discovered that while the Supreme Court was top of mind for voters 50 and older, it was not as much of a motivating factor for voters 40 and younger. So I'm going to throw this out. If you're 40, 35 or so, and doesn't matter which way you voted, I'd like to know if the Supreme Court was also something that was a priority for you. Was it something as a motivator, or were there other issues? 40, 35 years old and younger, too. Would love to hear some calls from you as well. We'll open all the phone lines. And here's the number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter always, at Kerry, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Back in just a minute, latest news now from Phil Picardi. Hey, Phil.
Hi, Kerry. President Trump this morning tweeted, "Democrats should be ashamed of themselves. No wonder D.C. doesn't work." He says Democrats are not moving fast enough on approving his cabinet nominations. Today, Senate committees have advanced Trump's picks for Treasury and Interior Secretary. CNN reports Senate Democrats will boycott Trump's picks for Health and Human Services and Treasury Secretaries. Trump has fired Acting Attorney General Sally Yates. She questioned the constitutionality of Trump's refugee and immigration ban and refused to defend it in court. Trump quickly replaced Yates, who was appointed by the Obama administration, with Dana Binti, a longtime federal prosecutor from Virginia. Amazon founder Jeff Bezos says the Seattle-based company is prepared to support a lawsuit being brought by Washington State's Attorney General against the Trump administration over the president's executive order on immigration and refugees. The Washington Post, which Bezos owns, is reporting he wrote in an internal email to Amazon employees that company lawyers have prepared a declaration of support for that lawsuit. The White House says President Trump will leave intact a 2014 executive order that protects federal workers from discrimination based on sexual orientation. The White House says Trump is determined to protect the rights of all Americans, including the LGBTQ community, and he continues to be supportive of gay and transgender rights. And the French-Canadian university student charged with killing six Muslim men during evening prayers at a Quebec City mosque is known for far-right nationalist views and his support of the French rightist party led by Marine Le Pen. Alexander Bissonnet was charged yesterday with six counts of first-degree murder and five counts of attempted murder for Sunday evening's shooting rampage. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:39.
Of course, we're having a lot of conversations about politics in this first 100 days of the new administration. If you miss it, you have to get back to work. You have an errand to run. Always waiting there for you on the podcast. Just search NPR News with Kerry Miller on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Listen and then let me know what you think via Twitter. Kerry NPR on Twitter.
I'm Marianne Combs. Do programs like Siri, Alexa, and Cortana really make our lives simpler? How is artificial intelligence changing our relationships and our behavior? Join me for that conversation at 11.
Support comes from All Energy Solar, now scheduling consultations for this year's Made in Minnesota Solar Program. You can learn more about the Minnesota Made program and its February 28th application deadline by visiting allenergysolar.com.
Back to our conversation this hour. And Kimberly and Eugene, I want to go right to the phones here to Tara in Minneapolis, who I think heard us talking about religion. Is that right, Tara?
Yeah, I kind of am concerned, of course, about the conservative court coming up just for my children, because for 20-odd years, you're going to have a conservative court with the appointing. But I always wonder about the moral decisions that are made basically based on kind of the Bible, like the GLBT or abortion. And I always wonder, what about the separation of religion and state?
Eugene, would you frame that for us?
Sure. I should say, by the way, at the outset, I'm not religious. So whatever decisions I make, moral decisions I make, are certainly not based on religion, because I don't have a religion. But whatever decisions I make are based on beliefs that I have, ultimately non-rational beliefs about morality. Likewise, when religious voters, for example, make decisions, when religious legislators make decisions, they make decisions based on their own morality. Theirs happens to be based in religion. Mine happens to be based in secular ideas. The Supreme Court has made clear that voters and legislators are perfectly free to vote their conscience, whether it's religious or secular, on subjects that are basically that have secular relevance. It could be abortion, it could be marriage, could be a lot of other things. Neither religious nor secular people can mandate that everybody pray, let's say, or set up some official church for the country. But both religious and secular are entitled to turn their moral beliefs, whether they're religious or secular, into law. And in fact, historically, the civil rights movement was in large measure a religiously motivated movement. Look at the rhetoric of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. A lot of anti-war movements have been religious. There were religious components in the labor movement. Certainly the movement for abolition of slavery was in very large measure religious. So there's no violation of separation of church and state in voters or legislators acting based on their moral beliefs, whether they're religious or otherwise. Now, justices certainly shouldn't act based just on their moral beliefs to say, well, I think this is wrong, whether it, therefore it's unconstitutional, whether it's secular or religious moral beliefs. They have to be trying to follow the law and interpret the Constitution. This having been said, it's inevitable, given our constitutional culture, in which justices do make a lot of decisions that aren't strictly mandated by the text of the Constitution, which, to be frank, is often fairly vague text, they will include their moral beliefs in their various judgments. I think that's true about the death penalty. It's true about reproductive rights. It's true about same-sex marriage and various other things, too. And again, that doesn't matter whether it's a secular judge using his secular moral beliefs or a religious judge using his religious moral beliefs. You could say it's wrong in both cases or right in both cases, but there's no special exclusion for religious voters, legislators,
okay,
or judges.
Here's Eric on Twitter who says, if religion is to be a factor, maybe an atheist judge is best to better achieve a separation of church and state. And Kimberly, I wanted to ask you about evangelical voters who supported President Trump and some of the promises that he made about who this justice would be. I mean, there are expectations among that part of his base, aren't there?
Certainly. And I think that was the main reason why the president released this list of 21 potential justices in order to allay the fears by some evangelicals and Christian conservatives during the campaign that perhaps he would not be the right candidate for them. I think that was certainly a consideration for him in doing that and also talking about, abortion and other issues that are important to them. But I think it's also important to note that, look, while justices are human beings, they come to their decisions with their own beliefs and their own life experiences like anybody else. But the role of the Supreme Court justices is to make decisions based on their interpretation of the Constitution or of the statute or of federal statutes. That's basically what their decisions are to be based on. Now, to be sure, their personal views certainly may shape things in terms of, especially on issues like abortion. But they're supposed to look into the text that is before them and make a constitutional or statutory judgment on it. They're not supposed to judge based on their own religious views. Now, there are other times that views come into an equation. For example, with the same-sex marriage decision, while it wasn't taking into account religion per se, a big factor in that case, and it played out during oral arguments, is how the country has come to accept same-sex marriage, whether the overall thoughts, whether this was something that was accepted, whether this is something that was really the views of the American people. And there were a lot of concerns expressed that people really haven't figured this out yet. People really haven't decided for themselves. And perhaps we should give some time to people to come to their own decisions on that. And in those cases, that it plays a big role. But religion per se should not be a factor in making a judicial ruling.
You know, Kimberly, the way you put that, I get the sense that during the confirmation hearings, those are some of the things that will motivate the kinds of questions that the senators will be asking, aren't they?
Oh, certainly. I mean, the senators are going to ask if there are litmus tests and what their religious views are, whether
right.
that will play a role, what just sort of getting an idea behind what will go behind the decision making of these potential justices. But at the same time, if you've seen recent Supreme Court confirmation hearings, they have become notorious by these nominees doing everything they can to give the most vague and non-responsive answers as possible because these hearings have become so politicized. There was a time when justices, so long as they were qualified and had judicial experience and went to good schools and seemed like reasonable, intelligent people, would be confirmed unanimously, like Justice Scalia and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, confirmed by many of the same senators unanimously. That doesn't happen anymore. These splits go down party lines now, and the confirmation hearings are very, very partisan. And so the nominees have learned to try to evade the questions, evade answering questions as much as possible, which isn't really helpful to anyone.
Eugene, given what Kimberly just said about how politicized it's been, do you think the usefulness of the confirmation hearings are outweighed by the politics of it?
Well, they're useful for politics. I don't think that the confirmation hearings really help the senators decide what it is or whether they should be voting for a particular
because they already
know.
Is that what you mean? Because they already know how they're going to vote?
Well, I think either they know from their party affiliation, or they know from their meetings with the candidate in their offices. My sense is that those end up being fairly important. Again, it's not clear that people get that much out of it, but, you know, I think these people are seasoned politicians. They are good at reading people. My guess is these kinds of one-to-one meetings, being that we're human beings who care a lot about this kind of face-to-face interaction, are probably pretty influential for the senators. But I think the role of the hearings is for the senators and in some measure the nominee, but much more so the senators, to convey to the public their understanding of the Supreme Court's role. And it's conceivable that that is a valuable political role in the best sense of political, that it is something that conveys this information to the public and helps people talk about these issues we're talking about right now. So you could imagine that having that kind of value. But yeah, I don't think the value is, oh, the senators are now enlightened about the candidate's views. I don't think they're any more enlightened after the hearing, ever since the Bork nomination, than they are before the hearing.
Eugene, grateful for your views and your experience on this and the conversation. Thank you.
Very much my pleasure. Thank
you. Eugene Volok is a law professor at UCLA. A question here from Austin in Lakeland. Hey, Austin. Hi.
Hey there.
Hi.
So I was wondering, When I was trying to decide how to vote, I posed the question to myself and you know, to others. Given that the Supreme Court is so politicized nowadays, is it legitimate to vote almost for the Supreme Court over the presidency? To say, you know, I think the Supreme Court nomination is actually more important than the presidency itself, and so I'm going to vote for instance, Donald Trump because he's going to nominate a pro-life Supreme Court justice, and you know, I believe that even the unborn are given the should have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So, and I, in the end, I'm 23 years old. I didn't actually vote for Trump in the end because of a number of other factors, but that was one of the things that really pushed me towards voting for him.
Okay. So you are. It sounds like you'll be happy if Trump's nominee is someone who opposes abortion rights, opposes Roe v. Wade.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
All right, good. I appreciate the call to Elizabeth in St. Paul. Hi, Elizabeth. How are you thinking about this?
Hi, Carrie. Thanks for taking my call. It really came down, it was a twofold factor for me, kind of deciding who I was going to vote for. I mean, I was a diehard Clinton supporter, but I think that Supreme Court nominees are incredibly important, and it is kind of a twofold decision that that I go through and that I hope other people go through. I might be a little bit biased because I'm a recent law school grad, but I think it's important to recognize that judicial branch nominees, they're the only lifetime appointments that we have in the government, and you really have to think about that kind of generational impact that they can have if they're sitting on the bench for 20, 30, 40 years.
Right.
And likewise, I think it's really important, at least to me at this point, to keep a balance in the Supreme Court. We already have a vacancy that I think many will consider the swing vote, but the most likely retirements in the next 5 to 10 years will be from the liberal side of the court, will be Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Stephen Breyer. And I think it's very important to at least hold the court in some sort of balance rather than shift it wildly to one ideology or the other.
Yeah, I appreciate the call, Elizabeth. And actually, that's something that I wanted to turn to Kimberly on. Kimberly, I know it's hard to anticipate who's going to decide to retire when, but in this first term, President Trump could have, what, as many as 3 or 4 appointments?
Yeah. Yes, certainly. I mean, just actuarially speaking, there are several justices who are close to, if not octogenarians. So at some point, if President Trump is in office for 4 or 8 years, he will have the opportunity to name several judges to that court, to the point of the lifetime appointments. I've spoken to a lot of conservatives who would really like Anthony Kennedy to retire so that Donald Trump will have be able to fill that seat with somebody who is young and that will have a long-lasting impression on the court. Some of the folks on Donald Trump's list, including Judge Neil Gorsuch of the federal court in Colorado, is just 49 years old. And so he would, if he is selected, would have a very long-lasting impact on the court. That being said, in terms of both of the callers and how whether Supreme Court justices are more important than presidents, there have been time in history that the justice selected by a president ends up not being ideologically aligned with the president that selected them. I mean, with
David Souter, right?
David Souter is the biggest example in recent history, a Bush appointee who became a fairly reliably more liberal voter. But even, Sandra Day O'Connor and John Paul Stevens, a Republican appointee who in the end was one of the most vocal opponents to the death penalty, saying that he thought that it was unconstitutional the way that it impacted race in application. So it's not a guarantee that this will be somebody who is ideologically one way or the other. Yes, the impact is certainly long lasting with these lifetime appointments.
It's interesting work you do, Kimberly, and I appreciate you sharing it with us. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Kimberly Atkins covers the courts and politics. She's a busy woman for the Boston Herald, and she is their Washington correspondent.